welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Hope you had a good Labor Day weekend. Joseph Cooper recovering from his back injury. I'm hounding him to come back, and hopefully he will be back soon. Children as young as 12 years old are being sentenced to die in prison. Other than Somalia, the United States is the only country in the world that imposes life sentences on children. One such child is Kenneth Young. At age 15, he was tried in Florida as an adult and was convicted for his role in a series of armed robberies in Tampa, during which no one was killed or seriously injured. He was sentenced to four consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. There are thousands of children in similar circumstances in the United States. Award-winning filmmaker and documentarian Nadine Pequeniza wanted to put a human face, a child's face, Kenneth's face, on the American justice system's policies concerning children. Her most recent film is a PBS award-winning documentary series POV film entitled 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, which aired on August 4th on PBS. Nadine Pequeniza wrote, produced, and directed the film, and she joins us from Toronto. Welcome, Nadine. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Bonnie. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate it, and congratulations on making a powerful and very important film.
Thank you.
Also with us is the lead attorney for Kenneth Young, Professor Paolo Anino. He's the Glass Professor of Public Interest Law at Florida State University, where he's the head of their Children in Prison Project. He's also co-director of the Public Interest Law Center in Tallahassee, and he joins us from Tallahassee. Welcome to you, Professor Anino.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's good to have you both. Nadine, how and when did the plight of Kenneth Young come to your attention?
I first started looking at this issue when I learned of it because I live in Toronto, Canada, and so our treatment of children in the justice system is very different here. As you said in your introduction, the United States is the only country that sentences children to die in prison, and so I was quite shocked when I first learned of that fact. And so once I started looking into the issue, that's when I came across Kenneth Young's story, because he had applied for clemency back in 2009, I believe it was. And so a local paper in Florida, in the Tampa area, had covered his case. And so that's how I found it and reached out to Professor Anino.
And that's how it came about. Now, do you think that the public at large, I certainly wasn't aware of this, do you think that most people are unaware of these laws governing juvenile justice?
I haven't done a poll, and I haven't come across a poll that has that answer, but I can tell you anecdotally from the information that I gathered while I was making the film, because people always ask you when you're filming what you're doing. And when I described the documentary to them and the subject matter, they were very surprised. So even in the United States where this is happening, what I found is that most people aren't aware that this is quite a common practice.
Mm. Professor Anino, how and when did you become involved with Kenneth Young?
Well, it was a number of years ago. My students and I were doing research here in Florida on how many children we had in our prison system. And I had a student of mine, her name was Lauren Collins, and she was going through the data, and she came across Kenneth Young, that he received four consecutive life sentences for a non-murder. And she brought it to my attention, and I thought it was a mistake back then. I mean, I didn't realize that Florida was doing such a practice. And in fact, we checked into it, got in touch with Kenneth, and it wasn't a mistake that he actually did receive four consecutive life sentences. And for me, I've been going to conferences around the country, and I would bring up this topic, and everyone was saying how odd it was because they'd never heard of that practice before. So Florida was clearly, as far as non-murders were concerned, unusual compared to the rest of the nation.
Hmm. Do you have any idea, if you would also at this point, tell us about Jacques Bethea and his sentence?
Yeah, in this case is typical of juvenile crime. Juvenile crime, unlike adult crime, juvenile crime is over 80% is done in groups, whereas adult crime, the majority, the vast majority, is done individually. In this case, Kenneth was, it all happened within a 30-day time frame between 14 and 15 years old. And there was Jock Bethea, a 24-year-old convicted felon, and he was the drug dealer of Kenneth's mother. And Kenneth's mother owed money to Jock Bethea, and part of the way he was getting recompensed for that money was by having Kenneth, who was, like I said, between 14 and 15 years old when this happened, to assist him in these armed robberies.
Do you have
and Kenneth?
I'm sorry,
just,
go on.
I'm sorry, I didn't. And Jock Bethea, he received one life sentence, whereas Kenneth received four consecutive life sentences.
So do you,
very different.
Do you have any idea or any hypotheses, because I didn't see in the film any, as to why Bethea, who was the one who was armed, who threatened to rape one of the victims, who was 24 years old, who was a drug dealer, who was clearly in charge of everything, why he received so much a lighter sentence?
Well, I think part of it was a certain hysteria that was going on in this nation in the late 90s, in the early 2000, where you had this myth of super predators. And because of that myth that juveniles were super predators, many courts and prosecutors and others were treating juveniles as super predators and using that as an aggravator. That's a technical legal term to give an enhanced sentence to, because they were more dangerous than adults.
How is that?
Well, I think that was just bad science and just hysteria going on. We know that children are just the opposite. We know that children are different from adults, and their brain is still developing. Psychologically, they're different. Developmentally, they're different. And they're more amenable to rehabilitation. So that whole theory of super predators, it just was debunked.
Mm. At this point,
but because of that, though, Kenneth was part of that. He got caught up in that whole net of that mythology.
Before we talk more about Kenneth and Nadine, your relationship with him and how you did that, I thought we would just play that clip from the film introducing our listeners to Kenneth.
Everything happened so fast that she called classification, like, man, we got a juvenile down here, and he just been sentenced to life. So what they did was they grabbed me out the juvenile part and put me in confinement. And they were like, you can't come out of confinement because due to your sentence. And so it still hadn't rested in me that I got a life sentence, because I'm like, man, I couldn't believe that. I'm like, nah, this can't be true. They was like, well, Mr. Young, you know, you're not going home no more. You're going to die in prison. I'm like, who going to die? I ain't dying in prison. So I was in denial of that because it happened so fast. It's just like one day I'm 15 years old and I'm in society. Then the next I'm out and you telling me I ain't going to never go home? That's kind of like hard to deal with. And I couldn't grab the concept of that.
Nadine, how difficult was it to develop a trusting relationship with Kenneth Young, given his situation and the distance between you?
That's always a challenge when you're making films, is to develop a relationship where you build trust but also maintain objectivity. And as you point out, in Kenneth's situation, it was particularly difficult because he is incarcerated, and I live, 2,000 miles away. So international phone calls were off the table, but the connection was made through letters. And Paolo also, after he looked at some of my past work and we had discussed the project at length and what I wanted to do, and so his introduction of me to Kenneth when they were able to meet, I think, helped a lot in establishing initially that contact. But mainly our relationship built through exchanging letters. But the first time I actually met Kenneth face-to-face was just a few days before his resentencing hearing, because they had brought him down from a prison where he was being held in northern Florida to the Tampa area to await that resentencing. So it was more difficult than it usually is in a film, but I have to say Kenneth really trusted in the process. And I think part of the reason he did that is because he truly believed that he had changed, that he was rehabilitated, that he was remorseful for what he had done, and that this would be recognized. And so he was amenable. He wanted that to be shown in the film and in the courtroom on the day that he was resentenced.
Mm. Is that why you think he agreed to be the subject of this documentary?
I think so. I think so. It's always hard to say 100%, and I think people's reasons for participating in a documentary and maintaining that relationship with a filmmaker change over time. But Kenneth never expressed any regrets to participating in the documentary, and he we maintain a relationship still through letter writing. And I do believe from what he said to me in his interviews and in our letters that he believes that, you know, he has changed and that he's a different person than he was when he was 14 and 15 years old and committed these crimes. And I think he wanted the world to know that.
And Professor Anino, if you would give us a little background about Kenneth and his sister at this point. Oh, do we have to take a break, Paul? We do have to take a break. We'll come back, and then we will get a little background on Kenneth and his sister and his life as a child on Topical Current. Stay with us. Thank you for joining us for today's Topical Currents. We're visiting with filmmaker Nadine Pequeniza, who began her career as a broadcast journalist. And for the past 15 years, she's been creating award-winning documentaries for Canadian and international audiences. She's made 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story. And Professor Paolo Anino is the Glass Professor of Public Interest Law at Florida State University. He's the lead attorney for Kenneth Young and head of Florida State University's Children in Prison Project. Joining us later in the program, we'll visit with Essie Mathis. She's a youth justice advocate with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, where she's the family justice advocate. At age 17, her son was sentenced to life without parole. So, Professor Anino, if we could get a little background on Kenneth now and his sister and what it was like as a child.
Yes, Kenneth had a very difficult upbringing. His father died while he was at he was an infant, and he was early years, and this is really important, I think, his early years were was raised by his grandparents, who brought him to church, who really made a major influence on his life. But then his grandparents passed away, and he ended up with his mother, who has a drug addiction during those years, so was never home. By the age of 13, he had dropped out of school. He was never in any major juvenile offenses of any type, but there was never anyone home, and he was being raised by his older sister, who had children of her own, and so the upbringing was very difficult, pretty much on his own for many years, and we're all talking here before the age of 14, because at the age of right when he hit 15, that's when he got arrested.
Why, at 15 years of age, was Kenneth tried as an adult? And who determines that, and how do they determine that?
Well, in Florida especially, we give discretion to the state attorney, our prosecutors, and they decide which of the children to be transferred from the adult system, from the juvenile system to the adult system. In 1995, Florida took the lead in the nation in transferring over 2,000. So it was altogether with 7,000 children into the adult criminal system. So it's the prosecutor with has discretion on this issue, and that's what occurred here in this case.
Do we know why they do that?
Well, the answer is no. I mean, I think the answer is that different state attorneys around the state will have different policies on when they'll transfer or not transfer. I think they look at the type of crime it is, and in this case it was felonies, and that's what they were looking at. But this is a case where No one was ever went to a hospital. It was definitely there was a pistol involved, but again, Kenneth, it was Bethea had the pistol. Bethea had the car. It was Bethea's idea and plan. And what Kenneth's role was really was just to jump over the counter and grab the money. And that's what Kenneth did in these type of cases. So his role was not to take the lead, but to assist Bethea.
I'd like to bring Brian Stevenson into this, who talks about, you know, second chances here. And you interviewed him, Nadine, for the film. I just want to get a little clip of him.
With young people in prison, in adult prison, really began at representing people on death row. The United States permitted the death penalty for juveniles until 2005. When we finally persuaded the Supreme Court to ban the death penalty for children, I was clear that that would not be life imprisonment without parole would still not be a just outcome for many of these kids. And even after these Supreme Court decisions, we're finding lower trial court judges and in some state courts that are very hostile to these children. We had these people saying, oh, these kids aren't really kids. They're super predators. These kids aren't really like other children. They're criminals. And so we have to keep pushing that, fighting that. If you are sympathetic to the people who are victims of crime, as I am, then there's no population more deserving of our help than the kids who have been sentenced to die in prison for crimes they've committed. If I look at that population, they'll be some of the most victimized people in our society. These are the kids who have suffered physical abuse and sexual abuse and neglect and torture and mistreatment and poverty and malnourishment and all kinds of mental health problems with no help and medical problems with no help. And no one's done anything. That's the population that we're talking about. And if we respond to them in that way, then I think we come up with very different solutions than life imprisonment without parole.
Nadine, tell us more about Brian Stevenson. Was he actually involved in that case, Graham versus Florida, that changed that law?
Brian didn't represent Graham at the U.S. Supreme Court, but he represented another case in the same motion that was brought forward to the U.S. Supreme Court. Child named Joe Sullivan, who was also given a life without parole sentence. So Brian has been involved in three separate U.S. Supreme Court cases that have challenged the use of both the death penalty and juvenile life without parole. The first case was 2005. Then there was the Graham case, which went forward where he was representing his client Sullivan. That was in 2010. And then most recently he was at the U.S. Supreme Court again arguing the Miller case, which came out with the decision that mandatory life without parole is no longer constitutional in the United States. So that means that now judges have to take into account a child's level of maturity, the circumstances surrounding the crime that they committed when they're sentencing. So recognizing what Paolo Nino was talking about earlier, that children are different, they're mentally, physically, emotionally different from adults, and therefore they have to be treated differently in the justice system. So Brian's been involved in the movement to reduce the level of punishment, excessive punishment, that children have been receiving in the United States for over a decade. He founded the Equal Justice Initiative, which he's the director of in Montgomery, Alabama. And like the lawyers, like Paolo Nino and the many other lawyers who've taken up the cases of these children, he sees the other side that so often is not reported in the press, you know, what happened to these kids in their childhood that landed them in these situations where they're facing these very stiff penalties. And so you played a number of clips from Brian there. Mm-hmm. These are different ideas that he brings forward throughout the documentary. And it's really the reason why I wanted to focus on the case of one child who is really representative of the more than 2,500 kids who've received this sentence. I mean, they are really victims first before they become offenders. And it's that story that I think the media has done a very poor job of portraying.
I read that interview with you, Nadine. You make such a crucial point that in our society, there's a huge inconsistency in the way that children are treated. In some ways, you know, we're protecting them, maybe overprotecting them when it comes to some things, and clearly not in others. Would you elaborate on that and make that point?
Sure. And it's a point that was made by almost everybody that I interviewed in the film. And I think most people are well aware of the fact that, you know, we protect children in the sense that we don't allow them to vote until a certain age, to drink, to drive. I mean, there are so many restrictions that we put on what we allow them to do because we recognize that they don't have the mental capacity, the judgment, the foresight, you know, the understanding of consequences that are necessary for people, for young people to behave in a responsible manner. And so to all of a sudden consider them to be adults when they commit a crime just seems, it's irrational. So there's a disconnect there. And everybody that I spoke to in making the film recognizes that. So I think we have to deal with that in the justice system, in the way we treat juveniles.
The other thing I learned in your film, that as a youth sentenced to life without parole, they don't make provisions for rehabilitation for them. Like Kenneth had to pursue his GED totally on his own. But isn't that one of the points of your film, that rehabilitation of children should take precedence over punishment?
Absolutely. That is one of the points that the film is making, and it's also the point that the U.S. Supreme Court has made in three judgments now, because they recognize that kids have a special capacity for change because they aren't fully formed. So there's an opportunity there to really change people. And so when they're 14, they're not going to be the same at 26. And so if we take advantage of that, I think we can really have much better outcomes in terms of reducing recidivism and enabling people to, I mean, we talk about paying a debt to society. For people to really pay a debt, they have to be a part of society, and so they have to be able to contribute again to make amends for what they did. And we've seen that with many of the juvenile offenders who were lucky enough not to get a life without parole sentence. Offenders, you know, juveniles who committed serious crimes, and they have been able to be rehabilitated, to reenter society, and actually give back a great deal. And you'll hear that from Essie when you bring her on later in the program.
Professor, how long did it take you? How difficult was it to arrange this resentencing hearing for Kenneth?
Well, it took a number of years, was the preparation beforehand, since we were working on Kenneth, just developing his case and knowing exactly his story. I wanted to comment on that also about Kenneth when he was in prison. Because he received four consecutive life sentences, the prison system would not allow him access to all these different rehabilitation programs. Mm-hmm. And the main argument was that the prison system would say, well, he's going to die in prison, so there's no point in investing any money on him for a GED or any type of vocational work. So in many ways, Kenneth, I find just being an amazing individual, because in his years in prison, he has been able to rehabilitate himself through his own inner strength. And I believe in many ways that inner strength came from his really early upbringing with his grandparents. And he was able then to say that he was going to change his life and find direction. And so I think Kenneth's story, as the documentary shows, is it shows a perspective that even without the resources in the prison system, Kenneth was able to really mature and find himself. And in 11 years in prison, the only infraction he had was not making his bed on a Saturday morning. Mm. And I don't know how many of us would have that same history. Mm. So just a remarkable individual who found inner strength to change.
Is he different from other children that you've worked with?
Well, I mean, every individual is so different from each other. I mean, Kenneth is remarkable in the inner strength that he found that within himself. But all the children they enter, they're children. And I think that's the key fact that we're talking about children here, not adults. And the criminal law system simply isn't intended for children. It's intended for adults. And when we assume that children are adults, we make mistakes. I remember many years ago talking to a biologist at FSU, Florida State University, and the biologist said to me, after he asked me what I was doing, and he said, well, in biology, we always knew that the juvenile stage is different from the adult stage of life. And the legal system did not in many ways when it comes to this population. And I think that's why we have this really history of barbarism going on.
And somebody just wrote in an emailer that executive function areas of the brain are developing to allow for critical thinking and decision making in teenagers. They still haven't developed.
Right.
And of course, you had that psychologist, Nadine, who was testifying to that in the resentencing hearing. Professor, why do you think that Judge Sleet handed down such a harsh sentence at this resentencing hearing? I was so taken aback by his sentencing.
Well, I mean, I can't talk specifically to Judge Sleet, but I can talk in general.
Okay.
That what you have is a change of culture going on. For in the 90s, we were treating juveniles as adults, and the laws were all made by our lawmakers to treat them like adults. I mean, the state attorneys had discretion because the lawmakers gave them the discretion. And so what happened was once the Supreme Court of the United States said that this is cruel and unusual punishment, you have to treat kids differently for purposes of sentencing, it takes a while in culture and in legal culture specifically for that change of attitude to permeate all levels of our judicial system. So I just think it was more than anything else, it was a change of culture that was not yet inculcated in the rest of our legal system.
We need to take another break on today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with filmmaker Nadine Pequeniza, who's made 15 to Life, Kenneth's story. Professor Paolo Anino from Florida State University. He's a professor of public interest law. And joining us when we get back from our break is Essie Mathis, a youth justice advocate. Stay with us. Welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman, we're visiting with the filmmaker of 15 to Life, Kenneth Story. It's Nadine Pequeniza joining us from Canada. We're also joined by Professor Paolo Anino, the Glass Professor of Public Interest Law at Florida State University. And joining us now is Essie Mathis. She's a 2014 Soros Justice Fellow and works with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth as the family justice advocate, and she joins us from Southern California. Welcome, Essie, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor and pleasure to be here.
Essie, what is the Campaign for Fair Sentencing of Youth Coalition?
Well, actually, the campaign is a nationwide organization that is committed to full and complete abolishment of juvenile life without parole sentences, and that includes de facto juvenile life without parole, as well as mandatory as well as discretionary. We firmly believe that young people have the capacity to change if given the opportunity and given the support and resources that they need.
Now, Essie, you have very personal reasons for your involvement. Tell us how your life was impacted by both the violent crime and extreme sentencing.
Well, first of all, my son, my oldest son, Ralph, was 17 years old, and he was living apart from me in the state of Florida at that time, and I was living in North Carolina. I was totally unaware that he had become involved in some illegal activity coerced by adults who were totally misguiding him, and at the year that he turned 17, he was actually arrested, along with about 30 adults. He was the youngest in the group that was arrested. And because of his youth, because of his loyalty, because of his immaturity, because of a number of things, my son was not willing to testify against the adult co-defendants. And consequently, he was given 3 consecutive life without parole sentences at the age of 17.
And how long ago, how old is he now?
He is 40, and he will be 41 in October. And gratefully, by the grace of God, my son is a free man as a result of the Graham ruling in Florida. His case was a federal case, not a state case. And it's just grossly impacted our family in ways that I can't even articulate in the time that's allowed today.
Okay. And so when was he released from?
He was released exactly a year ago, August of 2013. He was released in the federal system in Jessup, Georgia. I live in Southern California. And so I had the pleasurable task of getting across country as quickly as possible to meet my son as he walked out of those prison doors for the last time.
Mm. Professor, where does Kenneth's case stand right now?
Right now we're at what's called the federal habeas stage. So we appealed it to the Florida Supreme Court. It was denied, and now we're entering the federal court system. And his brief in the federal court system is going to be filed in the next couple of weeks. And where we're asking in that brief is to the federal court, we're asking the federal court that the trial court made an error by not considering rehabilitation. That rehabilitation is required under the Graham decision and a meaningful opportunity of release based on maturity and rehabilitation. And we're claiming that there was evidence of rehabilitation. It was undisputed. The judge found that Kenneth was rehabilitated, but the judge also found that he was not going to reward Kenneth by releasing him for his good behavior in prison. So we're arguing that the judge got the wrong legal standard, that rehabilitation is the standard when it comes to children who receive extreme sentences.
And are you able to say what his prospects for freedom are?
It's very difficult to win in the federal system, but we are going to give it our best shot.
Essie, what kind of work is the Fair Sentencing, the campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth Coalition? Are they making headway? Have they accomplished anything yet? Or what have they accomplished?
I would say absolutely making headway. It's actually, just a few months ago, the campaign itself celebrated 5 years of success, I would say, in looking back and seeing how the work of the campaign has connected with other coalitions and people across the country, individuals as well as organizations, that are fighting toward the same cause. The most important thing is the work that's been highlighted on behalf of young people and really sounding, I would say, an alarm and raising voices across the country to say that children are fundamentally different from adults and that they should be given every opportunity to live meaningful lives in our country.
Nadine, what are your hopes for the impact your film will have on the juvenile justice system nationwide or specifically in Florida?
Well, we're working directly with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, Essie and her colleagues, to bring the film to communities where they are looking at making changes. So right now, because of the Supreme Court decisions, there's 29 states that are looking at legislative reforms and putting in place processes for kids to get these reviews. So, for example, in West Virginia now, after 15 years, children are to be given a review where the judge or a parole board will take into consideration their rehabilitation and look at giving them a meaningful opportunity for release based on that maturity and rehabilitation. And you were asking about successes of the campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. In the last 5 years, 6 states now, since 2012, since the Miller decision, six states have banned juvenile life without parole. And the 29 states that I mentioned earlier, they're looking at putting new legislation in place. Florida just passed legislation in April. So there's a lot of movement on this issue, and we're hoping that by using the film to bring it to different communities that are considering these changes, raising awareness, asking people to become involved in these discussions, because once they learn about the issue, they are interested. People care about this. Crime is a very important issue. And if you want to reduce crime, if you want to reduce recidivism, the way to do it is really through rehabilitation and alternatives to juvenile incarceration. And so I think there is a lot of progress. There's a lot of forward movement, and we're hoping that the film can just help raise the level of discussion and general involvement of people.
I also wanted to ask you, I was told that it's available for, you can stream it until September 4th, which is Thursday. Is that right? How else can you see 15 to Life?
Well, if educators want to use it, it's being made available through a distributor called Outcast Films. So the film can be purchased and used along with a lesson plan and a discussion guide in colleges and high schools. There's also PBS has a community network so that you can, if you join the network, it just means, you know, becoming a member, signing up, it's free. And then you can actually borrow the film and have your own community screening, whether it's in a public library or it could be high school, it could be at a church. And actually, Essie's been helping to facilitate some of the discussions that have been taking place at these community screenings. So it's Outcast Films, or if you go to the PBS website, you can organize your own community screening. And then you can also rent the video on demand, so you can rent it and stream it online as well, and you can find out how to do that through my website, which is the film's website. It's 15tolifethefilm.com.
15tolifethefilm.com. We'll have a link to that on our website. We need to take one more break on today's Topical Currents. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with filmmaker Nadine Piquaniza. She has made the film 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, and the website for that is 15tolifethefilm.com. Also with us is Professor Paolo Anino from Florida State University. He's the lead attorney for Kenneth Young and the head of Florida State University's Children in Prison Project. And Essie Mathis is a youth justice advocate with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, where she's the family justice advocate. Professor Anino, what is the Florida State University Children in Prison Project, and how did you come to head that?
Well, in 1997, Florida took the lead in the nation in placing children in the adult criminal system. And it, by that point in time, I was practicing juvenile law as a professor at the FSU College of Law. And the issue came to my attention about what was happening to these children in adult prison. We had one of our first clients, her name was Jessica, a 13-year-old girl who was charged with kidnapping. And she was one of the first children in an adult prison system. And we visited her back in 97 at the women's prison. And during a lengthy interview with her, at the end of the interview, my students asked her what she wanted. And we were assuming that she was going to say she wanted to be released from prison. Mm-hmm. That's what we took for granted. And finally, this little girl looks up, and she's like 4 feet, 11, you know, hair split down the middle, real thin. She was 13, looking like she was like a 10-year-old, looks up and says, "I want a glass of milk." And that really struck me as, you know, we're placing these children in adult prisons, but our adult prisons are not intended for children. And so that really was the beginning of doing research and advocacy for this new phenomenon of what was happening in the 90s and early 2000s of putting such large number of children mixed up with adults. And back in 1899, when the juvenile justice system was created in Chicago, the whole thought was we needed to separate children from adults in the jails and prisons because children were getting raped and molested and beaten in prison. So we needed to separate them. But then we began this experiment, and I hate to say this, but Florida took the lead in this experiment, social experiment, of placing kids again back into the prison system. And so it was a whole new phenomena, social experiment that happened. Florida took the lead, and we were the bellwether state, and then the rest of the states followed our example. And so that's how it all began. It began with research and early advocacy. Once we started realizing what was happening to the children in the prison systems.
I'm going to ask each of you, starting with you and Nadine, what can individuals, if someone wants to do anything to get laws changed, is there anything an individual can do?
Well, there's lots of organizations, justice reform organizations, that are working specifically on the issue of how youths are treated in the justice system. And I know on our website, we're in the process of putting together a list of organizations, but you can find them on the website for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. So there's local state organizations that are working on these issues. So I would suggest if you're interested in getting involved in what's happening in your state, to go to the website, Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. If you Google that, it comes up quite easily, and they'll put you in touch with people who are working on this issue in your area, because it's different state by state. People are at different parts in the process of the reform that's going on, so get in touch with the local organization.
Okay, and Professor Anino?
I would second that. I mean, okay. I really do think the Campaign for Fair Sentencing of Youth is an excellent place to begin for someone trying to help this population group. And really what we're talking about is trying to get the law in sync with the science and with common sense that kids are different. In addition to the Campaign for Fair Sentencing, in Florida we have Human Rights Watch. They've been very strong on this issue. Natalie Cato has been working very hard legislatively with Human Rights Watch. We also have Southern Poverty Law Center, David Utter. I mean, they both, Southern Poverty Law Center with David Utter, strong advocates trying to get the Florida lawmakers to realize the fact that kids are different and therefore should not be treated the same as adults, and that children are more amenable. And I think that's the key fact, that children, because they're children, are more amenable to rehabilitation. And we do need to provide that rehabilitation, and we need to provide it in a juvenile system, not an adult prison system.
And
so that's what. So I would begin with the Campaign for Fair Sentencing, and then also if people were interested in Florida specifically, would be the Human Rights Watch and Southern Poverty Law Center.
Okay, and Essie, I see also you're an ordained minister.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, and what would you suggest if people do want to get involved?
Well, I would suggest the very starting point for individuals is to care. I'm in this fight not because my son is still in prison. I'm in this fight because I believe that every young person deserves a second opportunity to live a productive life. I think that people, first of all, need to challenge themselves to care about what's going on. I think that individuals need to start having dialogue about what's going on. I encourage everyone listening to this broadcast to go to the link and watch the film. Have film screenings in your neighborhoods, in your churches, in your organizations, in your communities. And from that, I believe that that will generate more passion and more concern and more people raising up saying, hey, there's got to be something we can do about this. Both Nadine and Paolo have already listed two great organizations that individuals can tap into, but I really encourage them to start from the beginning and care enough about this to talk about it, to ask questions about it, and then to commit to do something about it.
You know, we've had two emailers who are saying they understand that these are children, but at what point, and I know that we're not, that none of you are scientists, but they're saying they're curious as to what point an adolescent is deemed capable of understanding right from wrong, good from bad. But I wanted to just point out here before you answer, and we just have a couple of minutes left, that In the film, I learned that 70% of children serving life sentences committed their crimes with an adult. And so does one of you want to answer that?
Well, this is Paolo Anino. I think the law in the United States is clear. We have a bright line test at age 18. Will that be changed in the future? I don't know. But as a matter of law, we treat that's the line that we have decided to divide. As we know scientifically, though, the brain's still developing after the age of 18. But as a matter of law, society has made that our sharp line for distinguishing the two groups.
I wanted to end before we go just listening to what Kenneth says at the end of after he has been resentenced to 30 years.
Can't be let it get to you. Can't be down because you got to always think, okay, I didn't have this. I was supposed to die here. This is what I was sentenced to. So when you got hope, now you say, whoa, boy, I got a little stretch down the line, but I got hope at the end. I see some light. You know, now you got to take that light that you see and make that light brighter by continuing to fight with your case. You know, I'm going to fight for what I believe in. I believe I changed. I believe I showed remorse. I believe I matured. I know that I ain't the same 14, 15-year-old no more. And that's what I believe, so I'm going to continue to fight for that. So, you know, it ain't over. It don't never be over for you till you're in the casket. You know, I believe, I'm a firm believer in that. When you hit the casket, then it's over. But other than that, you got hope. You got to continue to fight. It's a process. I understand that. Patience.
And those are the words of Kenneth Young. We've been speaking to filmmaker Nadine Pequeniza, who made the film 15 to Life, Kenneth's story. And we will have a link to 15tolifethefilm.com on our website. Nadine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's a pleasure.
Paolo Anino is the Glass Professor of Public Interest Law at Florida State University. He's the lead attorney for Kenneth Young and head of Florida State University's Children in Prison Project and the co-director of the Public Interest Law Center in Tallahassee. Professor, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it being able to be here today.
And Essie Mathis is a youth justice advocate with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, where she's the family justice advocate. Thank you all. Thank you, Essie Mathis, for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And we thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow at this time, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. We return on Thursday, beginning with a Topical Currents rebroadcast with Augustin Burroughs, author of This Is How, Surviving What You Think You Can't. Also, Linda Gassenheimer is here with Chef Michelle Sanchez. Join us then. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a great one. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.